everyone, this is Signs of Life from Symphera, and welcome to another episode of Outlets of the Sky, the Symphera Records podcast. We are back, and my guest on the show today is drone artist extraordinaire Luigi Verona, coming to us all the way from Berlin, Germany. Luigi is a drone-based musician, software developer, writer, educator, and the list goes on and on. On today's show, we take a deep dive into Luigi's world, and he offers up a big download of interesting information about his own approach to sound design, music in general, and has some good advice for anyone out there looking to break into the genre. Out now on Exosphere, Cloud Forms by Isostatic. Soaring above the canopy of woodland structure, UK composer Sean Costello's Isostatic project turns its gaze skyward with Cloud Forms. Also available now is Patterns of Sync from Half Tribe and Spin It on Symphera Records. You can find all of our latest Symphera and Exosphere releases on Bandcamp at symphera.bandcamp.com and exospheremusic.bandcamp.com. You can also support us on Patreon at patreon.com/symphera for exclusive content you won't find anywhere else. We are an independent record label, and any support is greatly appreciated. I love your webpage, by the way. It is so 1997 Netscape. I mean, it's just like really cool throwback, but there's so much information in there. I was diving through it. I'm like, wow, look at this guy. It's quite impressive, actually.
So the concept, I think, is 1997. I did work hard to make sure that the design is not. So I think like the visual design should be very clean, at least.
Yeah,
I hope.
No,
it is.
Absolutely.
But yeah, the concept is really 90s. Nowadays, people just don't have home pages. Like, what do you mean a home page? What
exactly
is this?
It's so funny because I was like, oh, well, wow, look at this. This is like a throwback, but it's not, though, in a sense, because it's very straightforward. And you're right. No one does homepages anymore. I wish people did that. It's so cool.
Yeah. Yeah. I actually miss that because I think with things like Facebook or whatever people are using, there's less maybe individual touch there. So yeah, I don't know, less of an individual touch. And when you have a homepage, even if it's designed not to the perfect standards of graphics design, hey, at least you can see what the person is thinking, doing, how they're structuring their information, because that's kind of cool. Facebook will structure your information for you, so you're not allowed to show how you're thinking, but maybe you would structure it very differently.
That's interesting. That's a very good point. Which leads me to my next question. As far as you go, I want to take a deep dive into your world. When I look through your webpage, I see all kinds of different projects and all kinds of different things that you're working on. How far back does this go? Were you always a tinkerer of sorts? And were your first like musical experiments started when you were a kid? Where did the musical journey all begin?
Well, yeah, so I started in the late 90s, and I think the relevant historical background would be that if you wanted to make music on your computer in the 90s, you either had to own expensive hardware and software, or you would use trackers. And so for those who don't know, trackers were programs or are programs that were first developed somewhere in the 80s, and they look a little bit like retro Excel tables. But you can actually make music with them. So you load up 8-bit wave samples, and they actually sound pretty good. You have to really compare 8-bit wave sample with like CD quality to really hear the difference, right? Either way, it was much better than what you could achieve with like cheap MIDI sound of personal computers of the 90s. So kind of many people who wanted to do that would be using trackers. And the other cool thing about that was that you could see sources of other people's tracks. So you could actually learn from people's tracks how they did things. Although honestly, it was frequently used to really shop for samples that you didn't have, because there would be like a bunch of people who would own synthesizers, and they would sample the synthesizers and then create tracks out of these samples. So everybody wanted that.
Yes.
Yeah.
I remember my first exposure to that. My first exposure to music really was watching somebody on a tracker. And I was like, dude, that is so complicated. Like I have no idea what you're doing, but wow, that looks really cool. So I guess that was my first exposure to the DAW, so to say.
Yes. Yes. But you know, when I was thinking about it, I think that there's kind of a deeper narrative here, because this tracker thing is really relevant to how I ended up doing ambient. And there's a very interesting effect on me that the trackers created, was that I basically stopped listening to mainstream music after this. And really, not because I wanted to be a rebel. I mean, there's nothing wrong with mainstream music per se. It's just that, so think about it. Let's say that if you buy hardware and software in the 90s, something like Cakewalk, and you have your synthesizer with your keyboard, and you start producing music, what you're going to be doing is producing music the same way as everyone did for hundreds, if not thousands of years, right? It's going to be a sheet music kind of situation, maybe some basic piano roll. You're going to be playing melodies on your synthesizer. But as soon as you get your hands on a tracker, you're effectively working with a musical tool that no one has used ever but these several hundred teenagers in the 80s. And so you're playing around with a tool that nobody knows how to work with, or nobody knows its capabilities. And I really think that people underestimate the influence of tools in our lives, and they really shape our environment and even our art, definitely our art. I think the fact that there's more guitar music could really be because guitar is just easier to carry around.
That's interesting. Yeah, I really never put too much deep thought into that. But yeah, the tool that you use absolutely affects the outcome. And I think that's what made you notice that.
And the thing is that tracked music sounds really different, even with high quality samples, right? So there are modern trackers today that people could be using. It's a small community, but people are still writing music with that. And still, you can still say that, oh, this was done with a tracker most probably. So I'll give you an example. So for example, trackers are able to mix instruments very easily. So imagine you're using your normal DAW. You have a piano roll and you're writing a bass line, right? So you write notes in this piano roll. If you want to switch quickly between, like, I don't know, one bass instrument playing one note and the other bass instrument playing the second note in the sequence, you have to like close this piano roll, go to another one. It's awkward. You're not going to do that. But in trackers, remember, these are kind of Excel tables. You're writing C5 on a row, and then there's a small number near which says 01, which means that it's referencing sample number 1. And so on the second row, you can write, I don't know, G5, but you can now reference sample number 2. Mm. And so you can create these bass lines, which are really kind of traditional to demo style tracked music, which you will probably hear nowhere else, because this kind of tool, the way it's built, is just conducive to this particular trick. And if you're looking at normal situations, then you are more likely to see a bass line which is modulated. So it's going to be one instrument, but it's going to be modulated using a cutoff frequency or whatever, a filter, right? Because it's easier to do this in your traditional DAW or with a synthesizer. And so these little things, they create tricks and things that you would never do otherwise.
So is that what you use to make your music these days? I'm totally curious now. You've piqued my interest.
No. But so let me maybe, if it's okay, if it's fine for me kind of doing this maybe slow approach to ambient, but I promise we'll get there and all of this is going to make sense.
Go for it.
So basically, I think, I think this kind of methodology, a difference in methods and tools, explains why whole generations of musicians who went through a school of trackers like myself will think differently and be open to experiences than people who probably won't get it. So, and every tool will have its limitations and capabilities, right? And I think like the whole clash between a more traditional kind of classically trained musician and a modern so-called electronic musician is that classically trained musicians don't understand the limits and capabilities of what the electronic musician uses, and therefore they don't understand what's skillful and what's not, what's challenging and what's not. And so sometimes this might lead to comedic situations. A couple of years back, I was participating in a music convention, and they had like a one-hour compo. Do you know these things, like one-hour competition?
Mm-hmm.
So basically, you're given a sample or something like that and given an hour to create a melody, and then people vote on that. And so I got second place. I was, I didn't get just one vote. And then a guy approaches me, and like, I know him, he's a good guy and he knows me. He's like, oh, this was your tune. I didn't know. I actually downvoted it because I thought somebody cheated and that they prepared a tune beforehand. And now they presented it as if they did it in 1 hour. And he thought I did something really complicated. But the funny thing is that it was really done in 1 hour, of course. What I used was I used a lot of transpositions in this tune. And this is something that is very easy to do in a tracker. Actually, it's also easy to do in a DAW. But I think, you know, like a classical musician is going to be thinking, oh my God, there's transposition happening. You have to think about it. You have to change every note. You know, you have to really approach it seriously. But no, you just select everything and move it up or down several notes. That's it. Right. But it creates this kind of effect. And the reason for this is that this option was open to me because in a tracker situation, it's one of the few effects that you can do to have your tune sound more interesting and complicated. You would be able to select the whole pattern, like this Excel table, right? And then I'm going to use keystrokes to just raise or lower notes very quickly. So people would do that a lot, again, because you have a very limited tool and you have to come up with tricks to make it sound more interesting, right? Every instrument does that. And so if you approach that as an instrument, and that's where I see this disconnect. And honestly, there's an even more comedic situation. And that is, I really apologize to any of the kind of classically trained academic musicians here, but there's this thing you would hear, electroacoustic music. Do you know it?
No.
Well, look it up. If somebody doesn't know it, look it up. It's a very interesting phenomenon. Basically, this is an kind of academic genre of electronic music. This is what people with degrees and PhDs in like music theory do. And to me, it always felt like this is what a person who doesn't understand electronic music thinks it should sound like. So it's like, it's very weird. And again, like, I think this is a misunderstanding of the tools of like, hey, like, why is this music sounding the way it does? And so it's very awkward, but anyway, but so, okay. So I'm done with this kind of, introduction. So ambient, right? So basically the reason why I was saying that is because when I got interested in ambient music, I was kind of ready to understand that using a normal DAW for this would not be really conducive to making good drone music. And I was specifically interested in drone music. I heard it on Drone Zone, Soma FM. You had Rusty in episode 3 of this podcast, right?
There you go.
So this is where I really heard ambient drone music for the first time and thought, wait a minute, that's interesting, right? But the problem that one faces in the modern world of electronic music is this. So think about our thousands of years of music history, right? The cool thing in that world is to come up with an original melody. It has to be interesting. It can be catchy. It could be complicated. And all of these depths were explored by classical musicians, by like pop music. All of that is explored. But in the world of electronic music, I feel that coming up with a new generative method is your road to success, because it means if you come up with a new method that you can create music that no one else can. So I think modern electronic music is mostly about the method. All those niche genres are basically exploring certain production methods that are unique to them. And ambient drone is one of them.
Yeah.
And so a lot of these genres like ambient drone are also unique in that if you think about a more mainstream genre, there's a very definite path to it. You can go to YouTube, how to make, you know, a rock song, how to play a guitar, and you'll get your answers. You can read about it. You can find a teacher. But if you want to make ambient music of the kind that is played on Drone Zone, how are you going to approach it? Right? Because even at the level of what is ambient music, the vast majority of people on this planet will say, well, it's kind of slow piano melody played over sounds of nature. That's what you get. And in fact, Chris, so right before this podcast, what I did was I went to YouTube and I punched into the search bar, how to make ambient music. So what do you think I found?
Dare I ask, you might have found my shining face smiling back at you.
Oh no. So your live streams are great. No, but like I actually searched for specific tutorials, like people saying, here's how you make ambient music. You know, like YouTube is now like really rife with these tutorials. So like you can learn seemingly anything.
Oh, yeah.
But interestingly enough, you will not be able to learn how to make drone music that is being played on Drone Zone, right? Ambient drone. So basically, yeah, it was all piano. It's like they would be like, oh, you start with a melody, then you know layer chords, then you have bass, then you have your pads, whatever, and it's gonna sound just like, you know, a slow instrumental. So basically, if you hear drone music and you're in this melody driven culture, you're growing up listening to this kind of normal stuff, and you hear Soma FM and you hear Steve Roach and similar names, and you want to reproduce it, I think you're immediately faced with a simple but very blunt question. How are they doing this? And that's basically what I faced in around 2006, I think, where I was like, okay, this is exactly what I want to do. I think I found it. But now, how do I get it done? And that's where my real ambient journey started, really, because figuring it out is not easy because there's nobody to turn to. Like ambient online, I think it probably didn't exist back then, but
we're talking about YouTube still in its, you know, infancy.
Yeah.
There.
I mean, man, I was one of the first users of YouTube. And it was like, it was a time when you could still follow all the top video bloggers, all of them. It's impossible. It was possible during that time, I actually followed everyone. It was top YouTube blogger. But anyway, so let's say you're trying to do something like Steve Roach, right? What would be your first approach? What do you think?
I would reverse a sample and put some reverb on it.
Nice. It's actually better than my first thought. So that's not, I went with the most straightforward thing possible. I just basically played out a very long drawn out chord.
That's it.
I mean, I thought that this is how you do it. You know, like you load up strings because pads kind of sound like strings.
Yeah.
Then you maybe put a filter on top, automate it a little bit. But you know, it was dull and it sounded nothing like the recordings that I was listening to on Soma FM. And of course, the problem was that I didn't know the method. And actually, static chords are fine. You know, a lot of early drone music, if you start like researching this, the history of drone music, it started with, of course, static chords and could be fun to listen to. But drone has evolved over time, of course, just like, you know, early house music has evolved. If you listen to what people were doing in the 80s and the 90s with the same hardware, and today it's like, oh my God, so many very interesting genres, which can be considered serious music, so to speak. And so basically, in 2011, I started a project called Droning, and it's right now, it grew into a collection of now over 290 tunes. That's a lot.
That's right? A lot. I was perusing through the Droning collection before we got on the air, and I'm fascinated by your music, man. And it's like, even to this day, I consider myself somebody who is firmly in the ambient genre. I still don't know how to make music like that. It's really complex. And a lot of people say, oh, yeah, like you talked about, just push down a key and string it out over the course of time. It is not that simple. There are so many nuances in really high quality drone music that make it unique. And if you need any further explanation or any examples of it, just go listen to Drone Zone. It's amazing how much detail and thought and care and effort goes into that type of music that the normal average listener simply doesn't understand.
But also, so we can actually go through methods on how to get that music created. And I can kind of walk you through my sweat and blood, which I'm very happy to do because it's kind of a chance for me to also kind of look back and think about how I got there. But Project Droning is a great example. You can actually follow the evolution of my methods, of how I started working with it. But so when I was talking about how I started searching for ambient tutorials, I actually stumbled upon one video, just one, that did deliver something akin to ambient. And that was some guy doing kind of tape loops. So he had like several tape loops and they had some kind of drones on them, kind of droning sounds. And he would mix them, like there were three or four of them, and he would mix them and, you know, just mix them through the mixer and change the volume and that's it. And that already sounded a lot more than somebody, you know, like just playing chords with drone out kind of reverb on it. And that is actually the start. And that's what you would, if you start researching ambient music, tape loops is something that comes up fairly early on in the history of this kind of music. And that's why I immediately felt, you know what, I need to get off the grid. I pretty much very quickly realized you cannot work in a grid. I mean, you can start with a grid, but then you have to take the result of that and do something outside of the grid, because drone music, the beatless kind, all these kind of pads and these textures, they are not really tempo-based, and they shouldn't be, in fact. As soon as they're tempo-based, it's already a different genre, you know?
Yeah.
And so I basically wrote a very simple program, incredibly simple. Like, I used some framework that allow you to do that, where it's like you launch a program, you can load up a wave file, and it will loop it. But, and it kind of, you can play tape loops, you know, just like Steve Reich. So very cool. But what I did was I realized that, wait a minute, what if I start kind of adding aleatoric music elements to that? And so I created this tool, which is called Tape Loops. You can download it from my website. It's also like Pure Data Patches that I later developed, this kind of visual programming language. You can take the patches and just use them in your setup. Mm-hmm. So basically the idea is this. Imagine you have a tape loop, but the loop, the period between loops is actually randomized. So you stop, the loop stops playing, and then there's, say, a period of 20 seconds that you give it, and it will decide what the pause between loops should be within these 20 seconds.
So it can
be
five. That's brilliant.
Yeah, next time it's 7, next time it's 19. And what it allows you to do is that if you launch several of these, you can start generating incredibly interesting soundscapes that you would otherwise not do. So again, right, this is a method.
Is it like a plugin for a DAW, or is it just like
No. So tape loop. So originally it was just, just a program that you launch. But Pure Data is kind of like, you can use it as a, I'm not sure if you can use it as a plugin. You can definitely use it as a standalone audio app. And especially if you can route it somewhere. But in my case, a Pure Data patch is really a MIDI program. So you can stick it in anywhere and send MIDI to your DAW and it will do that.
Wow. So,
yeah, this could be very handy, and specifically not even for generating melodies. You can try that, of course, and that's also kind of interesting. But you can, it's actually very cool for creating, you know, sound effects kind of layers, because you don't want to do that manually. So that allows you, because people are really bad with randomization. We're really bad with that. And so this thing is truly random, and at times this is exactly what you want.
Oh, especially when you're that deep inside of a soundscape or a drone, there should be zero predictability, because once there is, then you sort of fall into a pattern. And I think, you know, personally speaking, that's one of the traps that I fall into when I make music like that, is I'm very much a tempo-based artist. And so when I, like, dude, get me off the grid and I'm lost. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's
Maybe that's fine. I mean, maybe that's not necessarily, like, doing things off grid might not be your thing, right? But if you would tell me, hey, I want to do things similar to what is being played on Drone Zone, I would argue that if it's not impossible to get that on the grid, but it's much more difficult.
Yeah.
And it's really about the approach. You're going to spend a lot of work on that. So basically when I think about the method that a composer uses to compose their music, it has to be, number one, reliable. Number two, scalable. So what I mean by that is, reliable means that you can reproduce your results, right? If you're a very, like, beginner musician, you're going to create, like, a bunch of shitty tracks, and then one track is going to be great. But actually, you don't know how to do that again because you're not sure how you got there, right? I think that happens to everyone, especially when they're starting out. It's like, oh my God, I had these shitty tracks, and then I have this one track, which is, I don't know, like, everything just worked together so well. but I tried doing the same thing and it didn't work out, right? This is a standard story. Mm-hmm. So you want to make sure that your method that you eventually come up with is reliable. You can get the same quality result again and again and again. And then scalable is something that you can do relatively easily. So imagine that you're thinking, oh, I have a lot of resonant frequencies in my sound. So let me take an equalizer and start automating the hell out of it. And I'm going to spend, I don't know, a week doing that. I mean, that's not realistic. You're going to do that once maybe, you know, to fix a very promising record. But if you want to churn out tune after tune after tune, you're not going to be doing that. And so your method has to be scalable. It has to be, you know, in effect, simple. Mm. And so that's basically, I think, where everybody should try to get eventually. And so when I'm saying that this kind of music should be done off the grid, I feel that in the vast majority of cases, this is the only scalable, you know, reliable method to get there. Even if you're starting, let's say that you're writing some sort of a pad and you're doing that, of course, in your DAW and a piano roll, which is tempo based, that's fine, sure. But then you're rendering this to a WAV file or a FLAC file. You're loading that into another project. And that's when you start actually playing with it and treating it not as notes, but as a sound sample, as a texture, and not as like, that's, I think, the key thing that I had to really understand about ambient music in general, or maybe this kind of electronic music, is that we're not working with notes anymore. We're working with frequencies. We're working with sound as a malleable product, basically, as this kind of medium that you can sculpt any way you want.
Yeah, immediately it just becomes more of the art in itself. Like you think like an artist, like I'm putting layers of color over my painting and therefore it's becoming something else. It's like a different form of art entirely.
Exactly.
That you're creating.
That has been exactly my argument since forever. Like I think I have a bunch of articles on my website where I argue exactly that. Like I've always felt that, and I think a lot of that reasoning came from talking to people who are actually classically trained and who would listen to some of the things, not even that I'm doing, you know, who cares about that? I'm fine. Like I would accept that, hey, maybe my stuff sucks, but I would show something that I really like and they would say, yeah, but there are no melodies here. Like it's empty. It's like an introduction to something. And I always, like initially I had nothing to say to them. I was like, there are no melodies, right? Like, what do you know, man? But like, I feel there's something in it. And so I started arguing, you know what, maybe that's actually a different form of art. And today, the more I'm in it, and I've been at it, scary to say, over 20 years now, but I'm now sure pretty much that this is really a different form of art. It has different rules. I cannot prove it right now, but I'm fairly certain that if you scan the brain of a person who's listening to kind of non-melodic music, something like ambient or even electronics with rhythm, but no melodies per se. And somebody who's listening to like, say, you know, classical music or pop music, different areas of the brain are going to be active. I think that's my hypothesis.
You're right. You're right on track with that. And it's almost like analogous to the artists throughout the 20th century where they were creating different forms of art and then bouncing them off between each other. And then sometimes I didn't even know what to call it. So it was like, well, what is this? What kind of art are we actually creating here? And is it something new? And the musicians of today have so many tools at their disposal. And now that you're carving your own lane, the deeper you go, the more you probably realize that, hey, this is something entirely different and it should be treated and respected as such.
Yeah. But you know, honestly, I think this is one of those arguments where, first of all, I think it has been won already. The argument is won. It's just not won with words. It's won with action. A whole generation of musicians, when you talk to them and say, but there's no melody here, they won't understand what you're talking about. They'll be like, what are you talking about? That has nothing to do with melody. Look, I think because a lot of people are exploring these tools, it's kind of not official, probably, so to speak. So there's no like academic force behind it that I know of. Obviously, probably somebody wrote something. But in general, I think it's becoming more acceptable without this official thing. Simply because this democratization of tools allows everybody to do that. I think people began to just viscerally understand, no, this is a thing. It has its rules. There are masters of the genre that, and it's very difficult to emulate them now. And you cannot just say, oh, it's like, you know, in the 90s, you could be forgiven, you know, thinking that, oh, all this trance house music is just dance music. But nowadays, when you're hearing some acts, I typically, like, this is an older act already, but they were the ones who really set me on the road of understanding of, wait a minute, this is like, this could be kind of serious music, you know, a lot of depth to it. It's Safi Brothers. This is like a dub techno project, but they're really known in the kind of dub techno community. But the important thing is that the development of their tunes is just, it's just amazing. It's unbelievable how they develop their tunes. There are no melodies, and yet the tunes are really, really rich with meaning. And yeah, it's just incredible. I wouldn't, like, it's the music that you can't really call, oh, it's dance music, like, simply because it has drums. It does. It has bass lines and drums, but there's nothing dance about it, so to speak. So, yeah.
Okay, so you are also a programmer, and you make this music. So let's fill in that last gap there. So 2011, you started making drone music, and you found yourself creating tools and using tools at your disposal, whatever you found. And so how did you sort of like break out, I mean, into this well-known musician that you are now? Like, were you just like... did you start like just throwing albums out there? Because what I see is a project drawing that's gone on for so long. How did you gravitate an audience to you? And then where were your first, you know, notable points of exposure?
Yeah, so it was basically all thanks to Soma FM, actually. And to this day, there are basically two areas of exposure for me. One is Soma FM Drone Zone. So a lot of my tracks are being played there. And so a lot of people are coming to my Bandcamp. And then there's kind of a separate Bandcamp community, so to speak. People who have discovered me on Bandcamp and started urging me to put out more music on there. So I kind of have like a small amount of followers, but a lot of them seem to like my stuff. I'm not sure if I'm that well known, but I seem to be relatively known among ambient musicians. So what I realized or what I noticed is that when I go to, like, for example, Ambient Online forums or some Reddit community, there would be like a couple of people saying, oh, Luigi, yeah, we know you. Like, you know, so I guess like my name is out there. I wouldn't necessarily call myself like a very well-known musician, but yeah, a lot of it was just, look, this is what I want to do. And even for, you know, a long time, I was thinking I don't want to be a recognized musician because I don't want audience kind of interfering with my ideas. Because if you become known, popular, or somehow gain an audience, as an artist, you can become influenced by the audience. And I think almost every artist had to face that if they had the situation. I wouldn't say that I'm at the point where this is even really happening. The only thing that I could sometimes see is that if I put out a tribal ambient album, then people who seem to go only for beatless things won't buy it. And if I put out, you know, beatless things, then suddenly several people who haven't been around for a long time start purchasing this. And I'm like, okay, so that's their thing, you know?
Yeah, yeah. You've established yourself in the genre and built an audience around it. I love that. Wow. I'm really fascinated by it, man. I mean, how did you pick up programming too? And you said like you started building tools to help you with the ambient music. Was programming like your vocation before you actually got into music, or was it just something that sort of the two things developed side by side?
I think they developed side by side. So, I mean, if you start getting interested in computers, then there's a very clear segue from computers to programming in a way, because if you want to be creative with a computer, the only way to really get creative is to learn to program it, to tell it what to do. I mean, it's not pristinely true. There are many tools that you can use, but it's sort of true. And so I started working as a web developer, actually, back in the day, and doing a little bit of C++. So this was kind of my day job, and that allowed me to kind of get into it. I wouldn't say that I'm a very advanced, you know, engineer or anything like that. Anything that I develop, I typically develop for myself. I also develop games, which is like, you know, kind of a hobby of mine as well. But the important thing is that I'm no longer afraid of the code, you know? So if I need to get something done, for example, the patches that you can find on my website, these aleatoric patches of pure data, This is visual programming language with very good tutorials. Anybody who is not an engineer can, you know, come in, read the tutorials, and start putting together patches. This is similar. So Pure Data is basically an open source version of Max. This, what is it called? Max 3D or something. I forget the name of the tool, but this is like this known, also like patch visual programming tool on Windows and maybe Mac.
Max for Live by Cycling 74. Is that what you're talking about?
Yes, exactly. Yes.
Nice.
So Pure Data is kind of an open source version of that.
Let's back up a little bit too. I just want to put this question out there for anyone who's listening, because your story is fascinating, your insights are fascinating, but let's bridge the gap here. It's 2020.
Yep.
What advice would you have for anyone who's listening to this show who would want to get into doing and making the music that you make, but has no idea where to begin?
Nice question. That's a very good question. So, okay, advice. Okay, I'll give advice. Let me maybe structure it a little bit. Okay, so let me maybe divide it into a couple of kind of goals that people might have. And one goal is getting more skilled at music, and the other goal is becoming successful, you know, like being recognized as an artist. So, and then I guess it makes sense to also think differently about beginners and kind of advanced people. So let's say, so you want to become skilled at, say, ambient or really, really any other genre of music, and you're a beginner. So my advice, try as much as possible. When someone says, don't grab every new plugin, this does not refer to you. Grab every new plugin. Try every new DAW. You know, talk to as many fellow producers as possible, get as much feedback as possible, develop thick skin, because you're going to get a lot of negative feedback, and that's fine. You'll learn to filter that later. And basically be prolific, because you really have to learn, and in many cases learn very mechanically, just do it and do it and do it. You know, focus on the result that you're getting. There's one thing that is probably true for everyone, and I'm not sure what the cure is, but you will miss a lot of the things that you don't know are important. And I think this is true for everyone, right?
Yeah, for sure. It's true for life, man. That is a life advice in a nutshell.
Yes. Like, I remember back in the day that I was exposed to techniques and like methods that I didn't really understand at the time. But now looking back, I'm like, it's all there. Why didn't I see that? But yeah. But you know, like for if you're more advanced, again, this is kind of intergenre advice, I think. But I think it's important for every producer to think about these things. So if you're an advanced musician, find your own sound. You know, you might not be the best. You might not be, you know, the most skilled musician of all time, but if you have your own sound that nobody else has, that at least makes you interesting, and that will allow you to get an audience that comes to you because you're the only source of that. And as I said before, make sure that your methods are reliable and scalable. Try to approach, like, every musician is a little bit like a production factory, right? It has to be, it's like, If you're working on music, at the very least, your DAW has got to have a bunch of templates for you to load up. That you load up and you immediately have, you know, all the plugins, all the routing, everything. You cannot spend time on that anymore, right? So you have to build up these things. But it could be much more. Your methods, your go-to tricks, and your go-to scenarios of how you want to develop things. So all of these things. Because at the end of the day, and actually statistics show this, that the most successful musicians are typically those that are very prolific, and they're going to have a lot of releases, and only several of these releases are going to be interesting, right? And then, so Chris, this leads me to this other thing that I'm really passionate about, and that is the question of success. How can you become successful as a musician? And, so I have looked a lot into the literature on that, actually. There's a lot of scientific research that basically tries to research success and how to get there. And I really don't see evidence for a universal success recipe, but there are several things that I can talk about it, like about in terms of success? Because I think, you know, a lot of us producers, that's like a very key question, because at some point in time in your life, you can be asking, why am I doing this? Like, nobody is listening, right? And especially as a beginner, you have to get used to the reaction of not negative feedback, but no feedback, you know, no reaction. You're putting out your first tune and you're thinking, okay, they're going to say it's great. And then another part of your brain says they're going to say it's awful. But in reality, nobody says anything because nobody knows you. Nobody's listening to it.
And this goes for any genre, but particularly the ambient music genre.
Exactly. Yeah. So the niche thing, keep in mind that it's, you know, like connecting with producers is very important. I still feel kind of isolated. I find it very difficult to connect with producers who are ready to share their methods. My approach is this. If somebody writes me, sometimes people do and ask me, oh, I want to get into ambient. How do you do that? My approach, I'm going to tell them everything. I'm going to give away all of my so-called secrets, because if I think about a world where the majority of people who want to try to do ambient don't know what they're doing for many years, and a world where people are doing like interesting ambient music, I'd rather go for the latter.
Oh, yeah.
But not all people think that way. And I have encountered this many, many times when I would reach out to a producer that I like, hey, man, this is great music. Like, let's maybe exchange like our methods. What do you think? No, usually there's like, I'm not going to tell you how I'm doing it. This is like my secret. And it's kind of, you know, disappointing. But so let me kind of, so there's on the Ambient Online forums, there was this thread a while back where people were talking about success, right? And so this is kind of the second part of what I would really like to maybe talk about in terms of like giving advice, you know, because this is could be a very disheartening experience. And so if anybody wants to do things like ambient specifically, like you said, Chris, right? Mm-hmm. You have to be ready to go into this. If you know, let's imagine that there's 100% chance that you will never become successful. You will not be known. You're not going to become a recognized artist. Are you still going to do this? If your answer is yes, cool, do it. If your answer is no, at least pick another genre, please, because this is going to be tough. And one of the kind of maybe more advanced kind of advice would be that, you know, like as producers, we frequently end up making music for fellow producers, really, because those are the people who are more charitable to sort of at least appearing to listen to our stuff, right? As opposed to random people on the internet. So you go to your community of fellow producers in your genre and you're posting your track and people are very kind and they're leaving comments. Oh, great track, man. Maybe you should do this. Maybe you should do that. And so what I recognize is that a lot of people end up doing music for their fellow musicians. And at the same time, I always feel that other musicians are kind of a less loyal and interested audience, because at the end of the day, none of us artists really have much time to listen to music. We're really creating ourselves most of the time. At least that's like true for me. So in my work, I always try to be relevant to ambient fans, not to fellow composers, because sometimes you can even see that certain opinions that you receive about your music could be valid from a very strict professional production point of view, but maybe not as valid from the point of view of somebody who just wants to listen to ambient music. And I'm not talking about dumbing things down, just that some concerns are not as important and you'd rather focus on something else and move on, you know? The thing is that I feel that this message of, hey, success is kind of random, kind of dependent on luck, and it's kind of a game that you're unlikely to win, this is actually a very positive message. And several people came back to me and said, look, because you kind of talked about this, I felt that like I'm feeling at peace with where I am right now, because maybe I feel that I'm not a failure is basically what this message says, is you're not a failure, that you're not successful. That's really not your fault, because really today it feels like, oh, you can release it to everyone, right? But in reality, the situation that the internet has created, this global connectivity, is that there's really no market for good music anymore, because you are competing with the best of the best. I'm putting out a record and the same week Steve Roach puts out a record, which is just immaculate. And his experience, and he's doing that every day. You know, this is his job. And a lot of us are just kind of accomplished amateurs who have a day job, who cannot put the same amount of thought and care into what they're doing simply by virtue of having to do other things in their life, right? And so not only that, you have pretty much a winner-take-all market, which is the music business, right? And as soon as you have a star, second-best artists largely don't matter. Like, of course, even ambient world will have several stars, but when you have like 70 Steve Roach albums, why would you want to spend time on anything else, really? I mean, I'm kind of exaggerating, but the general idea is this, right? You have smaller stars, but that's the thing. There's so much material, and there's kind of a positive feedback loop as well, because, you know, if your release is not paid attention to immediately, that's it. Things like Bandcamp, you know, all these services, they will maybe feature new releases for a while. But if you don't get that attention, that's it. You're done. But you know, another thing is that ambient is a very niche genre to begin with. And there could be this illusion that, oh, but that means I can get noticed, right? Because there are not a lot of musicians. Wrong. Because actually only several famous ambient musicians are capable of completely filling up a playlist of the small audience of ambient fans, or at least this kind of ambient drone fans, right? Compared to other genres. So if you go into like rock music or pop music, you have huge amounts of people listening to huge amounts of artists. Whereas with a genre like ambient drone, you have like, I don't know, like it's difficult to estimate, of course, but thousands of people, hundreds of thousands listening to thousands of artists.
Yeah, it's relatively small in the scalability, right? I understand.
Yeah, but it's like, I think it's an interesting thought that it's an interesting illusion that, oh, there's not a lot of people in the genre, therefore there are a lot of chances I'm going to be successful. Nope. Nope. But yeah, anyway, so practical advice, no more philosophizing. Practical advice. Number one, don't ever, and like I mean ever, sell your albums for a high price. You know, like Bandcamp will tell you €7 or $7. No. Nobody knows who you are. Just, you want to get reviews, right? You want to get more support. From the marketing point of view, it always helps if your album has a lot of like icons of people who really like your music and purchased it. And maybe there's a review. So make it like $2, $3, things like that, so that it's accessible to people who don't know you. And I think at this point, especially if you're just beginning or you don't have a big audience, you're probably not making money anyway, right? So you don't have to worry about that. And then, make sure that people review your work. This really, really helps. And then if you have a lot of releases, don't release them all at once. So that's also kind of helpful. Bandcamp right now introduces a lot of things. I'm like talking a lot about Bandcamp because I think it's one of the few platforms where you can really grow an audience that is ready to support you kind of financially. And I think there's a difference between when people just say, oh, great music, man, boom, like, you know, and when somebody says, hey, I really want to support you. And frequently this is like nominal support, right? It's not that people are giving you means to make a living. In the vast majority of cases, for many of us, it's not going to happen. But just understanding that somebody was ready to spend a bit of their money on your music to kind of send you kind of kudos, that's great. So yeah, kind of my advice would be to like let people do this easier, because sometimes it's a little funny to see somebody who's like has one album, there are no followers whatsoever on their account, and their album is like €10 or $10 or whatever. I'm saying euros because in Europe, they automatically convert everything to euros. So
it's really become this thriving community. And like you said earlier, the community of Bandcamp is ready and willing to support those artists who they cherish and deem valuable. And it's also a great opportunity for them to build a following and build a community around their own music just because of the network now. I remember when Bandcamp first started, there was no network. It was just like you had to point your own people to your Bandcamp page, but then they changed all yes. that. And then that opened up the floodgates. And now we have this beautiful network inside of itself, this sort of a functioning machine, if you will. What would you say to other ambient musicians who want to branch out into other subgenres of ambient? How does that tie into the whole success aspect? Because you mentioned that you know, musicians or musicians in general are like a production machine. What if they wanted to, say, get involved in something like just strictly drone music, or they wanted to go the other way around? They were drone artists and wanted to go to some more chill out ambient stuff. How would they go about doing that?
Well, I mean, in general, I would say do it. You know, somebody's interested in that. And obviously getting into a genre that has more listeners is actually a little, like, increases your chances of getting noticed, I guess. In general, music is a really oversaturated market, like in general on planet Earth, you know? I think we've been sold on this dream of become a rock star thing. In the past, this was actually not the case. Being a musician meant being poor, actually, for long, long stretches of time in human history. And only in the like maybe second half of 20th century, we have this emerging legend of, hey, you can become a rock star. So, I mean, even tempering your expectations on that level is helpful. But yeah, branching out is a great thing. And I think eventually you do that because you might get kind of bored with what you have. You want to move on. But in general, I think branching out into things where you can deliver high quality kind of ambient texture could be really nice. So, for example, I see some ambient artists go into ambient techno or ambient house. That could be great because if somebody doesn't have this kind of serious ambient background, you will hear, like, they will have interesting drums, but kind of dull backing, like kind of, you know, chords played, sustained notes. Whereas somebody who is doing things like, you know, drone music, they can come up with really great atmospheres, and adding drums to it can become really a winning combination. So yeah, for sure. I'm not sure if this will actually increase your chances of success, but definitely basically dabbing in like several areas here, that's definitely helpful, I think.
Would you recommend those artists rebrand themselves? Like, do you think that's helpful? Because we were talking about, like, you know, focusing specifically on an audience that appreciates what you do. Would you recommend, like, oh, I'm this artist and I come out as a different name because I'm now producing a different genre? Or would you just kind of, like, branch out and say, I'm one of those artists who does all of this stuff?
It's a very good question. I think it really depends. So I'm thinking about this myself. So in the past several years, I started doing a little bit of micro house and really trying to get good at that. And I'm thinking, if I release this thing on Bandcamp, all of my followers are going to be like, dude, what is this?
That's what I'm saying. That's exactly what I'm talking about.
Yeah. So I'm not sure. On the other hand, you realize that you already have like this established thing, and like, I don't know. I'm not sure. I don't have a good answer to that.
The elusive question. I finally stumped you on one.
Yeah.
Well, eventually we'll all figure that one out. Is there anything else you'd like to add to the interview before we wrap it up? This has been such an informative and fascinating time that we've got to spend together. How would people find you? Let's just start there. How do people find you on the internet?
Well, they can go to my, remember, 90s homepage, luigiverona.com. Usually if you Google that, it'll come up. You can also Google Project Droning. Usually, you know, will turn up some helpful links. Or you can go to luigi.bandcamp.com. I think like the most interesting bit here is that Luigi is not spelled like normally. It's spelled L-O-U-I-G-I. So that's where, but I think Google usually suggests spelling. So yeah, luigiverona.com, that's where all of my work is linked from. Even if it's like Bandcamp or SoundCloud, yeah, just go there. It allows you to explore my writings, my software, my music, so all of that stuff.
Is there anything else you'd like to add to the interview?
I think I've talked enough.
Well, you're just such a well-spoken and fascinating guy, and I wish you nothing but success and luck in the future. Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
I hope you enjoyed episode 10 with Luigi Verona. You can catch up with all of his latest work and catch up with all things Luigi at his website. Go to luigiverona.com. That's LuigiVerona.com. You can also support his musical efforts by purchasing one or his entire drone series at luigi.bandcamp.com. Be sure to follow everything Simfera on social media. We are on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and now have our very own Discord server. We've got a lot more exciting announcements and releases still to come in 2020. For those artists who are interested in working with us, either on Sinfera or Exosphere, the email address to send your demo is info@sinfera.com. Stay tuned for more episodes of Outlets of the Sky. And as always, keep your heads in the clouds and your feet on the ground. My name is Signs of Life, and we'll see you all on the other side. Peace.